Hi everybody, this is Ayushi. I know it's been a while since I have posted my last episode. The past 2 months have been quite a roller coaster ride for me actually. One of my family members was sick from COVID, actually my mom, and I was busy taking care of her for over a month. She's recovering now, but time was a bit stressful. So that and some other issues that I had to deal with, and so I didn't get time to for my podcast. So anyway, I am back now. I hope all of my listeners are healthy and safe. We are living in very unprecedented times, and just be happy and be healthy. That's all I want for everybody. So today I will be narrating a chapter from a book, which is The Tales of Prison Life. The book is actually based on the life of Sri Aurobindo, who was actually a freedom fighter in India during the British colonialism. And he was a freedom fighter turned spiritual guru actually. Basically, a bit about his life. Well, he was, give me a sec. So basically, where was I? Yeah, Sri Aurobindo. So he was born in Calcutta, and he studied for the Indian Civil Service in Cambridge, I guess, Cambridge, England. And he used to work in under civil service works in Baroda. When all the Quit India movement started, like the freedom fighting started in India, he joined politics in Indian National Congress, and also a revolutionary movement in Bengal also. So anyway, he was arrested because he wrote some articles against the British colonialism. And just because of exercising basic freedom of speech, freedom of opinion, he was arrested. And it was during this time, he stayed in the prison for over a year actually. And it was during this time that he found his spiritual calling. And his learnings are very spiritual actually. It's very global, very universal, regardless of culture, caste, creed, race. It's very, very worldly. I've read many of his learnings, and it's just so enlightening. And this chapter that I shall be reading from, it's called Prison and Freedom, from his book Tales of Prison Life. And without further ado, let's just start. Prison and Freedom. Men as we are, we are mostly creatures of circumstance, confined to the sensations of the outer world. Our mental activities depend upon such external sensations. Even our reason is unable to go beyond the limits of the material. And the joys and sorrows of life are but echoes of outward events. This slavery is due to the domination of the body. In the Upanishad, it has been said, the self-born has set the doors of the body outwards. Therefore, the soul of a man gazes outward and not at the self within. Hardly a wise man here and there, desiring immortality, turns his gaze inward and sees the self within him. Normally, the outward, physical eyes with which we observe the life of a man, in that kind of seeing, the body is our chief support. However, much we may call the Europeans materialists, in fact, all men are materialists. The body is an instrument for the fulfillment of the religious life. A chariot with many horses to pull it. The body chariot on which we ride across the ways of the world. But admitting the false importance of the body, we give such prominence to the physical mind that we find ourselves wholly entangled in outward activity and superficial good and evil. The result of such ignorance is lifelong slavery and subordination. Joys and sorrows, good and evil, affluence and danger compel us to mold our mental states in our own terms. And we too float along the waves of desire to which we give our thoughts. Greedy of enjoyment and afraid of sorrow, we come to depend on others, and receiving our joys and sorrows from others, we suffer endless misery and humiliation. Because, be it man or nature, whoever or whatever is able to exercise control over our body or can bring it within the field of its own forces, we have to submit to that influence. Its extreme example is to fall into the hands of enemies or a life of imprisonment. But the person who, surrounded by friends and boon companions, moves about freely, even his condition is just as wretched as of those who spend their lives in prison. The body is the prison. The body-centered intelligence, the reasoning ignorance, is the enemy that imprisons. The state of imprisonment is the perennial condition of man. On the other hand, on every page of literature and history, we find the irrepressible eagerness and enthusiasm on the part of the human race to gain freedom. As in the political and social spheres, so in the life of the individual in every age, we find the same endeavor. Restraint, self-torture, indifference, stoicism, Epicureanism, asceticism, Vedanta, Buddhism, Advaita, the doctrine of Maya, Rajyog, Hatha Yog, Gita, the paths of knowledge, devotion, and action. The paths are many. The goal is the same. The aim is always victory over the body, getting rid of the domination of the physical, the freedom of the inner life. Western scientists have arrived at the conclusion that there is no world other than physical. The subtle is based on the material. The subtle experiences are but reflections of the external experiences. Man's attempt to be free is in vain. The philosophy, religion, and Vedanta are but unreal imaginings and wholly limited to the physical reality of the mind's attempt to untie the knot or cross the limitations of her physical nature is an attempt doomed to fail. But the longing to be free is lodged in such a deep layer of the human heart that the thousand arguments are helpless to uproot it. Man can never remain content with the conclusion of the physical sciences. In all ages, he has felt vaguely that the subtle elements capable of conquering the physical limits are definitely to be found in his own inner being, that there is an inner controller a person forever free and full of delight within him. It is the object of religion to realize this state of eternal freedom and pure delight. The object of religious seeking is also the object of evolution, of which science speaks. Reason, or its absence, is not the real difference between man and animal. The animal has the power to judge, but in the animal body, that power does not develop. The real difference between man and animal lies elsewhere. A complete submission to the body is what constitutes the animal state, while in the conquest of the body and the effort at inner freedom lies man's manhood. This freedom is the chief goal of religion. This is what it calls mukti. It is for the sake of mukti that through knowledge we try to find out the mental guide of the body and life who lives within. Or through action devotion we try to surrender to it our body, mind and life. The central ethical injunction in Gita, Yogastha Kuru Karmini, this freedom is that yoga of the Gita. When the inner joys and sorrows, instead of depending on external good and evil, well-being and danger, become self-generated, self-propelled, self-bound, and the normal human condition is reversed, and the outer life can be modeled on the inner, the bondage of action slackens. The ideal person of the Gita renounces the desire for the fruit of action and practices active renunciation in the Supreme Person or Purushottama. He is Dukheshu Anudvignamana Sukheshu Vigata Spra. At attaining an inner freedom, he enjoys self-denial and self-control. Unlike the normal human individual, he does not seek out of fear of sorrow born of longing for pleasure. Any external refuge, he does not accept his joys and sorrows from others, and yet is free of the bondage of action. Rather, in the battle between gods and titans, it is the man sent by God, greatly controlled, a mightily puissant protagonist, beyond anger and fear. He is the man of yogic action who helps to usher in a political or religious devotion, or by preserving the established state and religious order, fulfills in a non-attached spirit God's own work. He is the superior person of whom the Gita speaks. In the modern times, we have arrived at the point of transition between the old and the new. Man is ever moving forward to his goal. From time to time, one has to leave the plains and ascend the heights. And it is during these periods of ascent that revolutions occur in the state, society, religion, as well as in the spheres of intellect. In the present times, there is a preparation, if nothing else, to move towards the subtle from the physical. Because of the minute examination and discovery of the laws of the physical universe by Western scientists, the outlying planes surrounding the upward way have been cleared. The knowers of the West are taking their first step in the vast inner worlds. Many are tempted by the hope of conquest. Apart from this, there are other visible signs, such as the quick spread of theosophy, the welcome given to Vedanta in America, the partial and indirect influence of India in Western philosophy and modes of thinking. But the most remarkable sign is the sudden and unexpected emergence of India. By claiming the role of world teacher, the Indians are rising to inaugurate a new age. If the Westerners are deprived of the help from India, they will not be able to succeed in their efforts at progress, such as in the cultivation of the supreme means to the flowering of the inner life. No country had excelled India in the knowledge of Brahman or self, that is, Tattvajana or Yoga. Similarly, the purification of the nature, the control over the senses, the power of the Brahman realization, the energy born of ascesis, tapasya, and the lesson of non-attached activity as yoga. These two are India's very own. To acquire by ignoring the outward sorrows and joys, the inner freedom is possible only for the Indian. The Indian alone is capable of undertaking activity in the spirit of non-attachment. While the sacrifice of ego and indifference in action are acknowledged as the highest aim of her education and culture and are the seed of her national character. The truth of this view I first realized in the Alipur jail. Those who live there are usually thieves, robbers, murderers. Though we were forbidden to speak with the convicts, in practice, this rule was not strictly observed. Apart from that, there was the cook, the waterman, the sweeper, the cleaner, with whom one could not help coming into contact. And many times we would speak freely with each other. Those who were arrested with me for the same offense, they too have been described in such unspeakable terms as the most heartless murderers. If there is any place where the Indian character may be looked upon with eyes of contempt, if it is possible to see it at its lowest, worst, and most hateful state, then Alipur jail is that place. Imprisonment at Alipur is that inferior and degenerate state. In such a place, I spent 12 months. Thanks to my experience of these 12 months, I have been able to return to the world of action with tenfold hope, with a fixed notion about Indian superiority, with redoubled respect for human character, the future progress and well-being of the motherland and the human race. This is not due to my inherent optimism or an excessive trust. Srijut Bipin Chandra Pal had felt the same way in the Buxar jail. In the Alipur jail, Dr. Daly, who had served there earlier, supported this view. Dr. Daly was a generous and wise person, experienced in the ways of men. The worst elements of human nature were present to him every day. Yet he used to tell me, "The more I see and hear of Indian gentlemen or the poor folk, men who are distinguished in society or the convicts in a prison, I'm convinced that in quality and character, you are much superior to us. Look at these lads," has further confirmed in my judgment. Who can judge from their behavior, character, and other qualities that they are anarchists or assassins? Instead of finding in them cruelty, wildness, restlessness, or impropriety, I find the opposite virtues. Of course, thieves and robbers don't turn into holy men while they are serving a term in prison. The British prison is not a place for reform of character. On the contrary, for the ordinary convict, it is but an instrument for the degradation of character and manhood. They remain the thieves and robbers that they had been sent before, being sent to the gaol. They continue to steal even in the prison. In the midst of the strict prohibitory rules, they manage to indulge in addiction, continue to cheat. But what of that? The humanity of the Indian survives every loss, fallen because of the social abuses, crushed out because of the loss of humanity. In the outer personality are the distortions of dark, dubious, shameful emotions. Yet within, the nearly vanished humanity seems to save itself in hiding, thanks to the inborn virtue of the Indians. It expresses itself time and again in their speech and act. Those who have seen the filth outside turn away their faces in contempt. Only they say that they have failed to find in them the least trace of humanity. But one who has given up the pride of holiness and looks at them with one's own natural clear vision will never agree to such view. After 6 months of imprisonment in the Buxar jail, Srijut Bipin Chandra Pal had seen God among the thieves and robbers, which he had openly confessed in a meeting at Uttarpara. In the Alipur jail itself, I too could realize this fundamental truth of Hinduism for the first time among the thieves, robbers, and killers in the human body. I could realize the divine presence. So this is the first part. This chapter is quite large. So I have divided it into two parts. This is the first part that I narrated. The second part will follow suit. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again for the second part of the narration of this chapter. Thank you so much for listening. Stay healthy, stay happy.